Hello and welcome. I'm your host Pooja Sarkar and you're listening to the podcast from the bookshelves of Forbes India, where we review books from the world of business, economics, finance and every other non-fiction title in between. Last week, we told you that we are going to spread the entire interview with Dr. Arvind Panagriya into two parts. The last part has been quite successful with a lot of you guys coming and listening to it. Thank you so much for the same. And this is the second part and we hope that you like it and you come back again. Dr. Arvind Panagriya, there's one thing that you talked about. You know, you say that the small policies or subsidy packages is not going to cut it for India. We really need a sea change in policies, which is the need of the hour. But while you were talking about the entire thing about bringing manufacturing to India, but we have also seen cases, for example, you know, a new government comes in a state and then they just suddenly cancel all your, for example, that happened in Telangana, where the new government came in and they posed restrictions on this entire renewable energy ecosystem. So investors are trying to bring in capital, but there are some new state governments that pop in and they come up with their own regulation, which is really causing a hindrance in terms of how governance is happening in the country at this point in time with regards to how we are treating the foreign investors, how we are treating the manufacturers who are coming to India. What really are your observations and your thoughts on how governance can be reformed? You have an entire section of the book about governance. If you could take us through on how the government really needs to step up or the kind of policies that they really need to come up with where investors feel safe with their investments at this point in time.
Yeah, so policy stability is important, and you know, too many frequent changes in policies do deter investors. That is not in dispute. I'm sort of, you know, not the state level policies that you talked about. Those worry me a little bit less because, you know, the investors do know that India is a democracy. And the governments do change, and the governments may have different priorities, and so therefore they may come in and make policy changes. It'll be good actually if, you know, any commitments that have been made already in the past to the investors, whether they are foreign or domestic, you know, regardless of that, that we keep those promises. But you know, the margins changes would happen. After all, this is a democratic country. I also don't think that the investors get so worried about smaller changes. It is only when, you know, changes are big, and often they are central government level changes, where then the tax liabilities get created, which the firms did not anticipate, and these liabilities go, you know, well into the past, you know, 10 years ago, what you did, that becomes subject to taxation. Although at the time, as you understood the law, you are not subject to such taxation. That, I think, then can create very large liabilities. And investors begin to feel that that's the sort of thing that has been happening with high frequency. That will deter the investors in a big way. But for small marginal changes, investors understand. I mean, you know, we have the examples of, say, Amazon and Walmart, both in India. Now they have weathered, you know, they have had to deal with several such changes. But barring some very big ones where the profitability can completely turn around from positive to negative, I think they understand this. And so they know that they are into the Indian economy for the long haul. So as I said, you know, we need to distinguish between policy changes that are done as a part of the promise to the people by a newly elected government versus policy changes that actually materially impact in a big way the long-term profitability of the investors. So policy stability is extremely important, but we also need reforms in a number of different areas. First and foremost, I think, you know, we need to be more open. No country in the world that I know of has succeeded building an economy with very rapidly rising per capita incomes without being open, without capturing the global markets, whether it is the South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore in the 1960s, 70s, and 1980s, or it is China in the last three decades. They've all been very open. They've been very successful in the global export economy. So that's something very important. From that perspective, you know, our turn to protectionist policies in the last two or three years has been in the wrong direction. Ultimately, when you tell, when you raise protection and say, I'm reserving the domestic market for my own firms, this is still a relatively small market when you compare to the global market. And if that is all firms are going to target, then they will not become large. Then you will end up with a lot of very small little firms. We have seen this happen actually in the assembly activity of the mobile phones. You know, we encouraged this over the last several years. So a lot of manufacturers came in, but they're all very small. Ultimately the largest ones are the ones that came from outside. Our own domestic manufacturers of mobiles are relatively small. So Samsung is the one which set up the largest factory in Noida. So if you really, focus the attention of your entrepreneurs to the domestic market only through this import substitution, then they will remain small. But if you really sort of push them towards the global markets, that's a market without limit. And that's where they'll grow large, grow bigger. And with the scale, your costs come tumbling down. Once you get to manufacturing of many, many million mobiles, then your cost is low. And the same is true of apparel, footwear, you name it. And that's how you create jobs. And remember, by the way, when manufacturing flourishes and a lot of workers are employed at decent wages, they spend that income. So that also increases the demand for services. And so the services economy also booms. So that's another point I make there that, look, if you manage to achieve success in manufacturing, it automatically paves the way for services, because services have to be locally produced for most of it. Not every service, but most of the services are locally produced. These are non-traded, most of the services. And so rising incomes in manufacturing always give to a second round effect on services growth. So that's the way for us to go.
And coming to the part when you talk about, financial markets and, of course, the banking system, you talk about how deepening the corporate bond market or the debt market is important. And I wanted to just put in this question that I really had. The government has been doing its disinvestments. We haven't been able to meet the target for this financial year. But most of the disinvestment has been happening in the form of the CPSC ETF, and the returns from the CPSC ETFs have been far lower than what the index has given us. So how can government really work on that? And second part, when it comes to the banking and financial services, when we talk about NPAs and the increase in NPAs, we have the IBC now, but the resolution is taking a long time. The first 30 dozen cases that we had 4 years back, they are yet to be resolved completely. So what are your ideas and thoughts on this?
So again, let's take them in sequence. So first, the disinvestment, and then we come to the NPAs and public sector banks and so forth. So on the disinvestment, I think a lot of disinvestment has happened, and in the 5 years the Modi government has probably disinvested more. Even if you take out the purchases that were done by another public sector enterprise,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Some of the stakes got bought by, let's say, LIC or one of these larger public sector enterprises. Even if you take that out, a very large volume of disinvestment certainly has happened. What has not happened, and what really I had been pushing when I was at Niti Aayog, was outright privatization. We need to return to actually selling off the public sector enterprises to the private sector such that the management of the enterprises passes on to private hands. The management ought to be replaced by a private board. And that means, you know, minimally you have to go below 50% ownership of the enterprise. There's something that has not happened. It has not been for the lack of will on the part of the government, because even while I was there, the cabinet had approved easily more than 24 enterprises for privatization. Then the bureaucracy effectively did not act fast enough to undertake that privatization. I think now the prospects are looking very good. We know that Air India, the government is trying very hard to privatize that. BPCL, the government has a clear commitment. And both of those certainly so far are moving forward smoothly so far. Now, ultimately, of course, whether the actual sale happens or not will depend on buyers coming forward. But I'm pretty optimistic that these sales will happen, both Air India and BPCL. The government has also put the LIC for listing. And that is a very big step, very, very important one. I hope they actually do it. You know, the government has announced that they will list LIC on the stock market, but I hope it actually happens. And then they will disinvest at least some stake in the LIC also. So I think that process now seems to be gathering steam. I hope it actually happens. I have no doubt about the intention of the government itself. Whether the process can actually deliver remains to be seen. Now, coming to the NPAs. It is true that in every case, the IBC process, the Insolvency and Bankruptcy Court process, has not been able to adhere to the deadlines, meaning that, you know, IBC process actually is a time-bound process. Within 180 days, you have to do this much, and then 270 days, it has to be completed, and so forth. But in many cases, it has been able to actually do it in time-bound fashion. Of the 12 cases, dozen cases that you mentioned, certainly one-third or so have been cleared, and some very large cases actually have been resolved. So IBC has been a success. I won't be skeptical. I won't be cynical of IBC. If you compare what the IBC has been able to accomplish compared to the process used to be in existence in the past. So you had SARFAESI, you had the Lok Adalats, you had the DRTs, the debt recovery.
The CDR.
CDR is a different thing. I'm referring to the processes that insolvency resolution processes. So those were under SARFAESI on debt recovery tribunals and Lok Adalats. Extremely slow, very poor recovery rates. By comparison, IBC actually is much faster. Recovery rates have been good. It is not still ideal, meaning, you know, in an ideal situation, every case should be actually resolved in the time-bound fashion. So there is scope for improvement. More tribunals need to be appointed. More judges need to be there. More staff needs to be there to move process faster. And, you know, in any case, there have been some teething pains in the implementation of IBC also. But the government has actually come forward each time to bring in ordinances, amend the legislation and so forth to remove the hurdles, remove the bottlenecks. So I think that process is working its way. I'm very optimistic personally that, you know, we'll get there. Good progress so far. But we need to be also careful in not letting the regulation weaken in terms of new NPAs. You know, you can't, you know, go back to this kind of forbearance that the Reserve Bank did for so many years, which actually led to this whole existing mess of the NPAs. You know, we used to restructure the loans without downgrading them. No country worth its salt ever does that. You know, in most countries, when you restructure a loan, the loan is downgraded to substandard, which means an NPA. But for years, the RBI, you know, looked the other way and allowed and this was the CDR, the corporate debt restructuring process, under which the RBI continued to let borrowers restructure the loan, not just once, but more than once, and not downgrade it. You know, but clearly, if you do that, then loans will keep bad loans will keep accumulating without being actually recognized and resolved. So it was only in 2015 that we ended this CDR process. But even then, for 2 years, we simply did not get to the resolution part of it. You know, the RBI governor at that time kept putting in new schemes like, you know, S4A. There were a bunch of other schemes that got put up to restructure. But that was not the way to go. We really needed to start actually cleaning up right then. That started in 2017, and the process is moving forward. So in the meantime, of course, we had other financial market issues come up as well. You know, the non-bank finance company crisis happened. Then we have had the debacle of the Yes Bank very recently. So as we have done some cleaning of the past problems, new problems have come up as well. But now I think is the time to get the financial sector, financial markets in order in the next 1 to 2 years and put it all on firmer footing.
True. I was just coming to that part on when you talked about the Yes Bank thing. You talk about the deepening of corporate bond market, the debt market, and everybody's been talking about it in India, trying to figure out how to do it. But if we see, for example, in the case of 81 bonds, where, you know, the regulator came and said it will be written off, and a lot of older people who had broken their FDs and, you know, bought these products from financial institutions thinking that it will give similar returns as safe returns of their FDs, and they bought these bonds. So how do you think what do you really think is the way forward in terms of, A, we do need a deepening bond market, but B, how do we tell people, you know, this is what a bond product is, or this is how a fixed income product works? How do these two merge together?
Yeah, no, I think this is a tough call. Deepening the bond markets is always very difficult. Not the least because, you see, bonds have a limited life, right? So it's a 5-year bond or 10-year bond or 15-year bond. In India, most of these are actually 5-year bonds. At the end of the 5 years, they get retired, right? So if you are trying to create a deep bond market, there has to be new issues continuously coming. This is unlike the equity markets. You see, the beauty of the equity markets is that as long as the company is alive, the equity stays. It has infinite life. So therefore, as a result, even though if you look at the new issues in India, they have been relatively limited, and there have been periods, you know, for some years to get that continuously, hardly any new issues happen. But still, now we have a pretty deep equity market. It's because, you know, it all accumulates. As long as the firms have not gone bankrupt and therefore closed down, the equity remains. Bond market is different. You know, so there has to be a continuous flow of new issues. Now, the problem in the Indian bond market has been, which is partly also a problem of equity markets, is that a lot of these issues, a lot of issues have happened, but they are all private issues. So therefore, you know, these are not traded publicly. So very small market proportion of the bond market, actually corporate bond market, is a traded on a daily basis. So it's also therefore not liquid. So there's a chicken and egg problem. If the bond market is not deep, then it's not very liquid. If it's not liquid, I don't want to put my money in it, because, you know, if I put my money in it and then I need the money,
I'm stuck.
Yeah, I'm stuck. So that is a bit of a problem. I think one way to proceed might be, you know, for example, allow the large funds to invest in these bond markets. You know, like the insurance companies, the LICs, and so forth. Some of the pension funds as well. They you know, because then they will have the capacity to assess the bonds also. And that sort of indirectly gives the people some stake in the high returns that the bonds may yield. But otherwise, you're right that, you know, the example you're giving that, you know, suddenly if the issuer of the bond defaults, then you're left high and dry. All your money is gone. So the risks involved can be high. And this is why you see we in India we have generally allowed only A-rated bonds. You know, we hardly have any, particularly where the bond market is very much needed is infrastructure. But infrastructure, obviously, the life of the infrastructure project is much longer. They need, you know, 10-year, 15-year bonds. But none of those are there because, you know, the ratings of infrastructure firms are often not so high. And so their bonds typically are not A-rated. And so, you know, this is a tough area. So I make some suggestions in the book, which are available. But this has been an area which has been difficult.
Faiza, I cannot let you go before asking, you know, we are in these uncertain times. Everybody's impacted due to coronavirus. You know, airlines have been asked to shut down operations in India from tonight, at least domestically. And everybody is now impacted. Companies are impacted. How do you see the economy moving forward with all this? And obviously, India, we've seen our fiscal deficit widening. We're estimated at around 3.5, but we came at around 3.8. If we see our economy is really struggling at this point in time, and then comes coronavirus impact, how are things going to move forward from here? What do you think?
Yeah, well, so I totally agree with you that we are all very, very impacted around the globe. You know, I can tell you myself, I've been in complete lockdown in my own apartment in New York City since 8th March. And at that time, you know, we had only 12 cases, but the government reacted and Colombia actually, you know, starting 9th March, Colombia went online at my university. You know, since March 8, I have gone out only once. And my wife, who returned from India on the 12th March, has gone out once. So you can see we are all very much impacted. You know, in terms of the economic impact, clearly there is a huge uncertainty. Look at immediately what has happened. Right. If you look immediately what has happened externally, international trade has been very severely disrupted. Movement of goods and so forth obviously is going to be hugely disrupted. International travel is practically banned. Hardly, sure. You know, any flights are going internationally. So there's a huge shock. Internally, on the demand side, right now, we are going to be all of us purchasing only what is absolutely essential. You know, I mean, in my situation, I'm not going to, for example, go out to buy clothing or furniture or anything. Only food is all I'm trying to look for, you know, that I get the essential. What is essential for survival is what I'm going to buy. So on the demand side, huge shock. And it can't be very different in India either because India is traveling the same boat. Our numbers are low still, but this is a virus on which nothing can be predicted. As I said, you know, 8th March is not that far back, and we had only 12 cases in New York City. Today, we are going to hit 10,000. On the demand side, only essentials are being purchased. On the supply side, hardly any workers are actually going to their workplaces. The only things that are getting done are what can be done online and the essential services. So clearly, you know, disruption is widespread. Now, if this situation lasts 1 to 2 months, it'll be okay. I think, you know, we'll come out of it with relatively limited cost. If the situation persists, 4 months, 6 months, we don't know, you know, until practically, you know, the a vaccine is found or a cure, which is a fully reliable cure is found. So it can take significantly longer, in which case the damage to the economy would be significantly large. Now, I don't like to venture into any of these estimates and so forth. I don't think we should, because the uncertainty is so much around such any estimate that you're going to make. So it's best not to. But qualitatively, this is what is happening, that external, both in terms of travel and trade, huge disruption internally, demand shock due because people are going to purchase only essentials, and a supply shock because people are not getting to their workplaces. So pretty severe. Let us hope, you know, that we come out of it in relatively short period, and that, you know, our numbers in India will remain relatively low. So far, so good.
Great. Thank you so much for your time, sir. Thank you so much for being on our show, and all the best for your book, and stay safe, be safe is all we can say at this point in time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You too.
Thank you.
Stay in lockdown. That's the message.
Yes, stay in lockdown.
Stay in lockdown. Don't leave, you know, don't leave.
Yes, yeah. True. Thank you so much.